This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners, and good morning, John.
John Lamb is in the studio. Hello, John.
Oh, good morning to both of you. Goodness, it's a bit like coming home after being away for a long time.
Well, it's true because we're just going to talk to John in a moment about the Good Gardening newsletter. Many, many gardeners, I'm sure, have subscribed to that and get it in their email boxes every second Friday. Well, this Friday is going to be the last one, so we're going to ask John why in just a moment. But we want your talkback calls as well, not for John, but for Sophie on 1300 222 891. Our text line is 0467 922 891. And I have a couple of ABC Gardening magazines to give away a little bit later in the program. But for over four decades, I think, John, your name has been synonymous with gardening. You were the host of Talkback Gardening here on 891 ABC Adelaide for over 40 years. In addition to writing features for The Advertiser for 20 years, you produced the South Australian Garden and Outdoor Living magazine. I brought one of my copies in from home. It's in my hand as we speak. And then, of course, the Good Gardening online newsletter. But as I said, sadly, Friday of this week marks the end of an era, with that newsletter being the last. And you let people know in your previous newsletter. What's the reaction been?
I've been completely overwhelmed, Deb. Probably there's hundreds of, because there's over, I think, around about 12,000 subscribers to the newsletter, and I think a whole heap of them have already sent a little email saying, good luck, thank you very much for your info, and the interesting thing is they're saying, will there be anything after this? Well, the newsletter is going to be closed, but hopefully we can establish a Facebook site. Could I say that the newsletter has been put out by me, but it's Steve Swan, my colleague, who's responsible for the layout and for most of the hard work behind the newsletter. And my son, Andrew, calls me a bit of a communication troglodyte because I don't get into social media. I don't have a Facebook page. And Steve is going to set up for me a Facebook page specifically for a good gardener and good gardeners. And it should be available by next week. So in next week's newsletter, which will be the last one, we might be able to indicate, here's how you actually, if you want to keep on going. And it's important because things like Darren Ray, he will be able to just give his forecast on a regular basis. And there are things such as when the citrus gall wasp come out and what's happening with soil temperatures and things like that. So it won't be poems of information, but when it's relevant, there'll be little pieces there. And if you want to be part of it, that would be great.
So, Good Gardening newsletter, and long live John Lamb's Facebook page when that comes into existence. Why did you make the decision to end the Good Gardening newsletter?
It's got to its use-by date. Everything has a use-by date. And with the magazine we were putting out for the nursery industry, this was going back 20 years. And at that stage, there were garden magazines closing all around Australia, and there were only probably the ABC Gardening and one magazine over in Sydney left. And so people were not using magazines to get their information. And Steve Swan, my colleague, we've been working together for over 40 years. He's a publisher and I'm a writer, I suppose, and he was suggesting, listen, why don't we have an electronic newsletter? And he was able to set it up and make it look good, and so that's how it all started. But the thing is, I've always, in my real life, as a communicator in agriculture, I've always carried out market research before I do something, and the market research about newsletters says people are drowning in newsletters. They're getting newsletters, but they don't open them. And we know from the click rates, you know, that the fact that initially, you know, people were, a tremendous number of people were clicking on, but the number is slowly dying. Mm. And Steve said, well, why don't we quit while we're ahead, John?
Well, look, we're in the era, aren't we? It used to be when we would watch the television news, somebody would speak for 30 seconds to a minute on a story. Now we're lucky if we get a 3-second grab. And really, with so much information available, and people's ability to focus is really reduced now. So, you know, you want your dot points. That's how people operate now. And actually sitting down to read a whole newsletter, a lot of people just don't do it.
That's a major issue, Deb, that there were probably the initial people older, like myself, have either tablets or a computer, and you can put it on a screen. But when you're putting out 10 or 12 pages of information, it doesn't fit very well onto an iPhone. And that's the new generation. The new section, the new generation of gardeners are real savvy, and they're not sort of interested in reading great tomes of information. They want instant information. They want it concise. They want it reliable. And that's tremendously important. And that the thing that worries me, of course, is that you can access information from all around the world, but is it relevant? And the importance of sound, reliable information. And Deb, I'd just like to say thanks to Soph for carrying on the Talk Back Gardening campaign of putting sound, reliable gardening information in front of gardeners.
About South Australia, where we live.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the thing, isn't it? You want that local advice. You can look up any plant you like, but if it's a plant in South Africa or in the wild moors of England, it's not much help to you here in South Australia.
It's interesting in putting together the newsletter. Obviously, we have to sort of cover our basic costs, mail-out costs and things like that. And so there are what I call supporters, and they put their information, but they're not allowed to advertise, or weren't allowed to advertise in the newsletter. They had to put it into a newspaper style. And some of them were getting smart and using AI. And so they put in an AI about, say, vegetables. But they didn't ask the right question and comes up with all the wrong information, and I end up rewriting the whole thing.
Oh no, and AI is a whole other conversation, isn't it? I mean, it's a threat to so many people's livelihoods, including communicators, and unfortunately it does get it wrong. And you know, there aren't as many fact checkers as there are companies producing AI information at the moment, so it's pretty tricky. John, just on the text line, Lulu says, devastated about John Lamb's newsletter finishing. I base my whole gardening regime around these and have learnt so much. What are we going to do? Thanks for all the wonderful information you've imparted over the years. But, of course, you can tune in via the Facebook page. And this texter says, thank you so much for all of your years of advocating for South Australian gardens. Our gardens are so much better for all your efforts. And Brett Draper has just sent through a text saying, to all of you, to Sophie and John, congratulations, John, on an amazing career in producing such an incredible and informative publication that provided South Australian home gardeners with sound technical advice. Wishing you and Steve all the best for the future. Warmest regards. And others echoing that, you know, it is very hard to get the local information. You can be told exactly what the pH is in a suburb here in Adelaide and get completely different information on the online world.
Yes, and I think it's creditable, the fact that ABC in Adelaide still has a talkback gardening program, a regular talkback gardening program, and not just a short program, one that goes for an hour and a half. And that says that people are serious about getting good gardening information that is local and relevant.
Exactly. Sophie, before we let John Lamb go, have you got any questions for him? I'd like to be a bit cheeky and put you on the spot, because I don't get the opportunity to interview you. This is the first time. So I would like to get a few quick questions to you. What is your best wow plant?
Hard to come up with one plant, but if there was one plant I had to recommend, I would say it was Trachylospermum, the star jasmine.
Ah, yes.
Simply because you can grow it as a creeper, and most people grow it as a creeper, but it'll grow in full sun and in full shade. Not many plants will do that. Not only will it grow as a creeper, if you are smart, you can grow it as a little shrub and sort of keep on pruning it so that it develops a stalk and it develops a lovely mounding shrub-like appearance. But more importantly, I've discovered that you can use the star jasmine as a ground cover. And I have one of those disgusting mop tops growing in my front garden.
Yes, I was going to ask you your least favourite plant, and I thought it might be the mop top robinia.
Well, it's there because it's on the western side, and it's huge, and to take take it down, it would destroy the whole environment there. But underneath it, I've tried. We've been living in the place for about 5 years now, and I've tried all kind of things, growing colourful things underneath it, and it's impossible. And I discovered, in fact, Jamie McIlwain, one of the landscapers who's regularly on this program, suggested, why don't you use your star jasmine? And there is a form which is a ground cover type, and it is absolutely brilliant. It's as tough as old boots. You put a little watering system for it. So, and you don't overwater it, so that you give it enough to water the roots of your star jasmine, and then once a month I actually water the robinia, so its roots are further down. But would you believe 5 years later and it's still sending up suckers?
Wow. That is incredible. Not great.
Oh, yes, but yes. Don't ever plant a robinia. But coming back to the star jasmine, it's brilliant. And as a ground cover, it is brilliant. And the important thing is to be tough on it. Once it's established and covering the ground, it'll send up its little tendrils. And once a month to this time of the year, you get the hedge clippers and just sort of give it a short back and sides. And it looks great all the time. And in springtime, you can let it have its head a little bit. And it's just brilliant with those beautiful white flowers and perfume coming out right through the front of the garden.
Oh, okay. I know what I'm going to be doing. Star jasmine, beautiful ground cover, also can be a shrub. But if you were planting a different shrub, maybe one that came to a bit more height, what would you recommend?
Abelia is something which is very, very underestimated. I suppose I'm coming from a place where I have a very, very shaded garden. My whole concept at the moment is to say, what are the things which will give you a colour in a shaded garden? And they're abelias, so long as they've got good light. There's a variegated ones, and they were as tough as old boots, will take full sun or sort of semi-shade, and they are very, very good. And in terms of colour, just people that have got shady gardens and want some colour, discover cane begonias. Cane begonias are brilliant because they'll flower for probably 9 months of the year. And there's also a thing called a mega begonia. A mega begonia, it's just an annual begonia on steroids. But it will flower in a shady condition, so long as it's got good light, all year round. And it's a matter of make sure you've got two. So you cut one back hard so that it flowers in winter, and the other one you cut back in springtime so it flowers during summer. There's a lot out there.
I know, but we're putting you on the spot for one only. John Lamb in the studio. We're talking about the final Good Gardening newsletter this Friday, but don't worry, there will be a link to a Facebook page, Sophie.
But I wanted to ask, John, what was your favourite topic to write about? We're both passionate gardeners and we're interested in everything, but what was your favourite topic?
The fact that the climate is changing and how to adapt to the change. We can either change the plants that we are growing, or else we can adapt the way we grow so that we can grow our plants as the climate changes. And probably the most important part of that is the fact that if we in the future want to grow our fruit and vegetables during summer and the climate has changed, we're going to have to protect them with shading. So climate change and the importance of shade, and it's the combination of proper watering, mulch and organic matter in the soil and shade on top of the plant will allow us to continue growing our fruit and our vegetables despite the fact that we're going to have hotter weather more often.
That's something I'm really passionate about too. And, obviously moving forward, we can't stick our heads in the sand. We need to adapt. But I'm really excited to see how many people are trying different things and having great success.
I like tilting at windmills, and I've always tilted at the nursery industry for not taking on the board of the importance of shade and developing simple shade cloth structures that will allow people to have shade over their fruit and their vegetables, but not something that looks disgusting. It looks, you know, as part of a nice landscape, but that's a story from the past.
Yes, but there are a lot of innovators are doing it themselves in their own gardens, but you're right. It hasn't been picked up as one would have thought. Sorry, Soph.
Can I just add that I have a structure that I'm growing my veggies in, sort of leafy greens, and it had some roof trusses, and I wanted to work out how to put shade cloth on and off easily. And, you know, in the old days you'd use those sort of gang nail things, and then it wrecks your shade cloth, and when you take it off you're going to rip it and it's all too hard. There's actually a little channel system that the commercial guys use, and it's not expensive. It's like a little channel C-section, and it has a zigzaggy wire. And someone came to my garden and said, we're using that to attach the wire. And so it means you can put shade cloth on when you want it and you can take it off, you know, like seasonally I'm talking about.
And you move it across like a curtain.
No, no, not that. They are great too, but they're really expensive. So this is simply a C-channel that you put on either end of the shade cloth. You obviously have to have some structure.
Oh, I see,
And you put the shade cloth in the C-channel, and this zigzag wire tensions it for you, and it's stood up to 70k winds out here.
Wow.
And that's something that's available in the commercial system that, you know, an average home gardener can go along and buy it, and it wasn't expensive. And it makes, you know, it makes reusing shade cloth, because, you know, shade cloth's plastic. If we buy it, we want to keep it forever. You know, we don't want to be ripping it every year trying to put it up, and we want it easy and manageable. So I love that idea.
Yes, that's great, Soph, and I certainly commend you and encourage you to be at the front of the nursery industry and keep on pushing them and making sure that they are cooperating and giving the gardeners what they want.
Mm, wonderful.
Absolutely.
Well, John, just to reiterate, John Lamb's last Good Gardening newsletter is this Friday, the 20th of March, but in it you will indicate what the new Facebook page is going to be called. Lots of people are asking for the name of it, including Harried from Paynham, who is sorry to hear that the Good Gardening newsletter will be no more. Jackie at West Croydon thanking you for the newsletter, and also Jeannie, who says, I think of you every time I go to the North Park Shopping Centre in Prospect, because there were 3 Robinia mop tops cut down and now they've grown back into full trees. So she always thinks about you when she sees them. And this listener saying, just wonderful hearing 2 beautiful voices, John and Sophie, together. So thanks for coming in, John. Keep us up to speed with the Facebook page, and we'll have to get you back in another day.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and I've certainly enjoyed the opportunity of many happy returns. Anyway, until just say good gardening.
Thank you, John. John Lamb, lovely to have him back in the studio. And just make sure, if you haven't subscribed to John Lamb's newsletter and you'd like to read the last one, get on to doing that. Just put JONLAMB or Good Gardening newsletter into your search engine and you can do it. And don't forget, Sophie's Patch has a newsletter as well, and you just put Sophie's Patch into your search engine and you can find that also. We're taking your calls in just a moment. The number to call is 1300 222 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We are Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson. The phone line is 1300 222 891. Joy in Glenside has called through with a dragon fruit question. Good morning, Joy.
Good morning, Deb and Sophie. I called in probably 12 months ago. I've put a dragon, well, I bought it from a plant store, a money raiser. It was established, but going up, straight up, and then a couple of laterals to the right side of the main plant. And so I planted it up against my brush fence at the back. It gets sun for probably 4 or 5 hours, and it is now got the first fruit on it. I've had it in the ground about 4.5 years, and it's the first fruit is on a short offshoot, 8 foot from the base, because I've had time to measure it while I'm waiting.
Awesome.
And, and it started turning red about 5 days ago, and I'm wanting to know, when do I know it's ready to be picked to eat? And the last bit of new growth is 11 foot from the base. How do I just keep cutting it off? Because I've cut about 3 pieces off, and it just wants to keep growing.
It's obviously really happy where it is, and obviously any of those cuttings you take off, you know, share them around, grow them on, donate them to a thrift shop. I left my dragon fruit at Mount Barker and was probably getting to the size where it would have started fruiting. So I've never actually been lucky enough to pick my own dragon fruit. Once they go a vibrant colour, apparently, you know, you wait till the fruit feels, you know, soft and plump like an avocado. Now, if you leave it on too long, apparently at the base the skin can crack and ants will start coming. So yes.
I've been watching it, you know, a couple of times a day.
Yeah, oh, I bet. And does it feel rock hard or is it starting to feel a little bit softer?
No, well, I only just touched it a short while ago and it is still very firm. And the little... Well, it's hard to explain what those... It's not. They're not leaves, they're sort of...
No, the little green bits on the fruit, yeah.
The green bits on the fruit. I would say it is about another inch to go to right at the end, but that doesn't seem to be part of the fruit. They're just sticking further forward.
Okay. So, look, the other thing you could do is contact Joe's Connected Garden, because I know they grow several different types of them and they would have hands-on experience harvesting them. Joe's Connected Garden or the Rare Fruit Society. So if you do social media, Joe's is on Facebook. Rare Fruit Society has a website. And if you took some photos and sent them along, some of the volunteers involved with both of those organisations would have hands-on experience of you know, harvesting and eating them. I have got a new one out here, but it's only a foot, you know, it's only 30 centimetres high. So it's a while till I'm going to be able, in the position of picking the fruit.
Well, I was just about to say, if you haven't got one in your garden, I've got a piece in a pot. It's grown 18 inches in... about 3 or 4 months.
Wow, that's great work, Joy. Oh, well, look, thank you very much. You'll have to follow that up and hope you get the answer that you're looking for. And thank you to Marilyn Crucial, who sent through a note saying, I think John's earned a rest after so many decades of helping SA gardeners. Thank you to that. And Andrew from Blackwood saying, it was gorgeous hearing John and Sophie interacting. Have great on-air chemistry. Thank you for that. Now, have we got time for Andre in Windsor Gardens? Let's find out. Andre, you've got a gerber, a daisy and a gladioli. You're asking what you need to do to dig them up?
That's right, correct. Good morning, ladies. Gerber daisy astracea, and I've been donated this plant and it's been kept well watered for me, and I want to know, when can I dig it up and bring it to my place?
Ah, okay. Well, look, really, autumn's not a bad time because we've still got warmth in the soil. And so if you were to dig it up, is it one of the hardy old-fashioned sort of salmon pink ones?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. It's because they're actually incredibly hardy, very old-fashioned but really, really hardy. So I would say from now on, obviously water it well before you dig it up so it's not under water stress, and, you know, use seaweed-based plant tonics when you transplant it. And which gladioli are they?
Oh, I don't know. I've been growing them for a couple of years and some of them have died off and gone brown. Others are still staying green. So
Okay.
They're about hip high.
Yeah, okay. So generally gladioli are lifted in the sort of winter time. There are different types, which is why I was asking. The normal old-fashioned, let's call them the Dame Edna-style gladioli, are lifted in winter. There are what we call miniature gladioli that are lifted in summer because they're South African bulbs and they die down to nothing over summer. And then there are the ones that flower in between. Like there is a stunning orangey-red one that's not quite as tall as the Dame Edna ones, and it flowers around Mother's Day, these stunning flame-coloured flowers, and that's also lifted in summer.
Okay.
That was flowering in spring.
Oh, well, there are different types, so
yeah,
it depends.
Might need to work out that first, yep. Soph.
Absolutely. So if they're the ones that are flowering in the warmer weather, you lift them in winter. If they're the ones that are flowering in the in sort of spring, you lift those in summer.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Andre. Find out what the sort it is, and that will give you an indication of when to lift them. We are having more Talkback Gardening calls very shortly. Call in on 1300 222 891. Love your comments on 0467 922 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning. Welcome to Saturday Talkback Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners, on this stunning autumn day.
Isn't it indeed? Perfect day to get into the garden. And if you would like some advice, you know what to do. Call now on 1300 222 891. 1300 222 891. If you've got a comment to make, we'd love to receive it on the text line 0467 922 891. And I have a couple of ABC Gardening magazines to give away. Right now, we want your calls on 1300 222 891. Now, Sophie, David has called in from Port Pirie. David, it's another dragon fruit question. Good morning.
I'm growing a dragon fruit in one of those little porcelain water containers that you use to get water out of. And I've had it there for a while, and I had it at one stage somewhere in the sun, and I noticed it was getting burnt. So I'm just trying to figure out the best place where I can put it in the ground.
Okay. Now, believe it or not, David, they love full sun.
And they love full sun.
They love full sun and heat. So if it's in one of those little, you mean those sort of white water filter ceramic things?
Yeah.
So that's pretty small. So I would be trying to, the problem with those is sometimes they come in at the top, so it's hard to get things out. So I would be trying to put it in a bigger pot. And you can, so generally what we do is we train them up a pole, and then they fruit on the horizontals or the bits that hang down. So
thinking about putting it in like in my driveway, where I get full sun anyway, and put some, and put a, not a, put some wire around, with two things in the ground to hold the wire up, which is over 6 feet tall and stuff like that, and let it grow that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen the places I've seen them growing best are either where they're trained up a post of a fence and along the top rails of the fence or something like that, and either can be open or have a back on the fence. So really it's like a trellis, or, you know, like the sort of supports you'd give to a vine, a grapevine. And then the other place, as you drive out of Adelaide, probably about Gawler when you're heading out the Northern Expressway, over to the left is an amazing Asian temple. And just beyond the temple, I see this orchard of dragon fruit, and how they're grown is on what looks like just a permapine pole in the ground. They're grown up and they're hanging down, and I'll have to pay more attention, but you know, when I drive past, it looks, as I glance at it briefly, like there's about 20 different posts in the ground, and they're all growing out in the open in full sun, and they're doing really well. So it wants full sun and heat.
Okay, I'll do that. And it takes a lot of water, does it?
No, they're really a desert plant. Once established, you know, they are very hardy and water-wise. Now, I'm not sure about how much water they need to fruit, but I would just say normal watering, and I think you'll find it will love your conditions and the heat you've got.
All right, one last question. Now, because I'm going to put it in the driveway where there's a fence, a foot away from the fence is okay?
I think you actually probably want it right next to the fence if you can. Is this a colourbond fence or a tin fence?
It's a tin fence.
Okay. So is it on the tin side or on the post side?
The tin side.
The tin side. Okay, so then probably having it offset a little bit would be good. I was thinking you could use a post to tie it up, but if it's on the other side, yeah, having it a little bit off that fence would be perfect.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, David. Great to hear from you. Good luck with replanting or repositioning your dragon fruit there.
And I have a feeling that David might have to crack that container to get it out. You know, pots are, I love pots and all sorts of recycled containers, but the ones that come in at the top, as anyone who's ever tried to get a plant out, are really tricky.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you've got to try and scoop the plant without damaging the pot.
No, so that pot might have to be sacrificed, David. So good luck with that also. Peter's in Goolwa with a rose question. Good morning, Peter.
Morning. How are you both?
Great, thank you.
Good. Now, I'm not a gardener, got no idea what I'm doing. But my daughter had a lovely rose, so I took a cutting off it. I put it in a pot. This is in January I did this, January this year.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's just a stick in a pot, but now I've got, it stayed green, which was good, and now I've got leaves on it. What do I do next? It's only in a small pot. It's just on the porch. I don't know what to do.
Okay. Now, if you give it a little gentle pull, is there resistance, as in, has it grown roots?
I don't know. I presumed it had if it stayed green and got leaves. I don't know.
Yeah, so I would presume it has too, but we don't know how, you know, full that root system is. So, you know, if you look at the bottom of the pot and you see little white roots down at the bottom of the pot, that means that the roots have more or less done the whole pot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could look to plant it out now. Or,
okay,
to be on the safe side, I would wait till winter. The leaves that it's got will drop off and plant it then. So, yeah, you know, basically.
So not worth leaving in a pot? You don't leave roses in pots?
Oh, well, certainly not little pots. I mean, you can grow roses in pots. They need to be decent-sized pots. I'd say ideally long-term, depending on what rose it is. You'd want 60 centimetres or more. But can I say roses in the ground are really hardy. Now, they do prefer a clay-rich soil. So have you got sandy, if you're
sandy
at Goolwa?
Sandy soil, high marsh island, yeah, sandy soil.
Oh, okay. So therefore, if you could get some clay from a friend on the mainland that's got, you know, clay in their garden, mix some clay through the soil and plant it out, it'll be easier. I mean, any plant in a pot in the hot weather, you've got to be watering daily. And that's, you know, if you're up for that, great. And depending what type of rose it is, because obviously some roses get, you know, 2 metres high, other roses are only a metre high. So that would determine the size
of the
pot.
This will be about the 2 metre one. It's a beautiful rose. But
the other
quick question was, do I put it under cover during winter or?
No. Roses are tough and amazingly rewarding. You know, we see roses growing right through Goolwa, you know, in full sun. The only thing I would say, they prefer a clay-rich soil than pure sand. So if you can get some clay and some compost incorporated through, you could start preparing the site now, preparing the hole now for where it's going to go. You know, get some compost and some clay and mix it through what you've got and get it nice and fertile and then plant it out in wintertime.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's only in potting mix at the moment. It's just
No, so, good on you, though.
Thank
you know
you.
What they
actually
absolutely they call growing a rose from a cutting rose rustling. So I love that term.
That is great. So you Peter, know, you're a rose rustler.
Yeah, and it's almost like you need a bandana or something. Be running around and grabbing rose cuttings.
Oh, wow. That is fantastic. Great images of you there, Peter, and good on you for giving it a go because sometimes in the garden that's just what you do and you can get success from doing it. Michael from Campbelltown has called in on 1300 222 891 re-geraniums. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi, Deb. Hi, Sophie. I've never spoken to you before, Sophie.
Well, good on you, Michael. I'm not that scary, I hope.
No, I've seen you on TV. You're all right.
Good on you.
I got some geraniums in the ground, and I lost a couple in the extreme heat, right? Even though I kept the water up to them. How often now do I need to water the established ones?
Oh, isn't that a good question? Yeah, you know, I would say a lot of this depends on your soil and also whether you've got challenges like tree root competition from big gums. So if it's good soil, you know, good organic enriched soil, you know, you might be just watering once a week if they're established. If it's soil that's a bit ordinary, you know, doesn't have much organic matter, because basically organic matter is a sponge that holds the water in the soil, you know, you might be watering a couple of times a week. And, you know, the thing is, if you've got, say, big trees that are drawing on the moisture you put out, that might mean you're watering a couple of times a week. But generally a good soak once a week at this time of year is what I would expect most gardens with reasonable soils should be able to survive on. I'm not talking about veggies. I'm just talking about the rest of the garden. And ultimately, you know, when I say a good soak, you're trying to get the water 30 centimetres into the soil. And how you tell that you've done that is simply dig down after you've watered, after you think you've watered enough, dig down and see how far that water's got. And often people go, oh, I actually thought I watered well and I've only got the water a little bit down. But, yeah, so I would think a really good soak once a week should be enough at this time of year.
Yeah, well, there's no competing gums or anything. There's no other competition either.
Yeah, okay. Well, so, you know, try once a week and just observe your plants. You know, usually March is, you know, we've got 35 to 45 in March. That's often what we expect, and then you'd be watering more frequently. But now it's cooled down. The nights are beautifully cool. Out here in the, you know, the desert, the locals hate that I say this, but... You know, it is. It's really harsh conditions. I'm just watering the bulk of the garden, a good soak once a week. And however, you know, the veggies get more.
Michael, a bit of experimentation sometimes is needed, isn't it, Sophie? You just sort of have to find that sweet spot for exactly where you are at the right time
Absolutely.
Of year.
Absolutely. And it's all based on your soil and the, you know, how much wind you've got and all those sorts of things.
So many variables. Karen is in Lower Mitcham. Now, Karen, you want to plant something in wine barrels. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you, ladies. Yes, I've got three plants that I want to put in wine barrels, and I did catch part of Sophie's talk on them, that you need to put the screw in around the metal part. But I'm worrying about the internal of the wine barrel. Do I need to paint that, put some plastic or do something else to protect the plants?
No.
Any leaching?
No, there's no worries about anything leaching out, you know, like because it's organic and food-based. Mm-hmm. Can I say wine barrels are gorgeous, but, you know, they're not going to live forever. They're affordable large pot and, you know, if you can get 10 years out of them, fantastic, and then, you know, more. Securing the ring is to hold them together and then they last longer. I have had people make, you know, line them with plastic because they want to do wicking beds in them, and you can do that if you drill in the right places. But no, I would just, you know, when I've used them, I've just planted straight into them and, you know, planted a mixture of all sorts of things from, you know, veggies to roses to whatever. They were a great option when I was renting and, you know, very affordable.
Yes, that's indeed. That's exactly why I wanted them, actually, because at the moment I just can't afford to buy the huge ceramic pots, which I know would last for forever and ever, but they're just so expensive.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, they are. And wine barrels, when you've got stuff growing in them, I actually really like the look of them. So, obviously the soil you put it, you need to make sure you've got sufficient drainage in the bottom. You know, you've got to drill those holes in the bottom. I would also sit the wine barrel on something so it's not straight on the ground. So, you know, a couple of old pavers or something like that, so you can make sure you've got good drainage. I would also probably put a layer of gravel or croc, you know, croc's old broken pots, in the bottom, and then put a bit of shade cloth on top so that we know that we've got good drainage. A couple of times I've seen where people have put drainage holes in the bottom but not enough and too small. So, you know, you want to make sure you've got good drainage.
Right, okay. Thank you very much indeed. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Happy planting, Karen.
Thank you indeed. Thanks, Karen.
Yeah, a few jobs involved there, a bit of drilling, a bit of lining and a bit of work, but all for a very good cause, I hope. Now, we're going to come back and talk about rats in just a moment, Sophie, but I'd like to give away a couple of ABC Gardening magazines. If you haven't won anything from the ABC in the last month and you would like to win one, we'll take one by phone on 1300 222 891, another by text. Please text through your full name and postal address to 0467 922 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson
on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We are Talkback Gardening, and Sophie, you have had a few texts through in relation to rats. John from Aberfoyle Park says, I want to thank Sophie for her bicarb rat killing recipe. 15 down so far after all commercial baits failed dismally. So well done there. Robin from Blackwood saying, can you get some scientific information on the dried potato, dry cake mix theory for rodent control? I think I'm just feeding our rats a main course and dessert. The plastic dish it was in even disappeared last night. And Rob in Fisher has rung through as well. Rob, what's your rat question to Sophie? Good morning.
Good morning, Sophie. I'm just wondering, would it harm chickens or dogs if they eat any?
Okay, now first off, can I just put this into context? Someone told me about this, and because I didn't want to put poisons out, I tried it. Now, it was powdered mashed potato that you buy in the bag, and I put it in a saucer. Now, it was inside a shed, so that, because I had bags of seed in the shed and the rats were getting into the bags of seed. And so it was inside a shed that I knew they visited because they're eating my seeds. So it was kept dry and it was up high, so it couldn't get to, so nothing else could get to it, right? So no dogs could get to it, no chickens. And apparently it's because the rats haven't got the ability to throw up. So they eat all this stuff, they can't throw up, and then they desiccate. And the important thing is, if you find a dead rat, if a bird of prey gets to it or another creature gets to it, they're not going to be poisoned, right? That's a really important thing. Now, just in the last week, I've had a conversation with someone because there are these different rat baits, and there's what they call first generation, second generation. First generation means it's just meant to kill the rat. Something eats the rat, doesn't get harmed. Second generation, it kills the rat. If something eats that rat, it gets poisoned too. Now, obviously, second generation is at risk to other animals, you know, like raptors or owls or all sorts. Now, the other day I had a conversation with someone who said even the first generation rodenticides, while they mightn't poison the creature that eats them, say if a bird of prey eats them, they make them sick. And then you might find a bird of a prey like an owl on a road, and then it gets skittled by a car because it's actually not well. So we really need to be cautious using any rodenticides. So I don't know that there is scientific information on this thing. Sabrina Hahn, who's my ABC colleague, just tells people to get a packet of vanilla cake mix, a vanilla sponge, and put it, you know, out in the box, and the rats come along and eat it. So this is not for mice, this is for rats. And it's something that I tried and it worked successfully for me. The gentleman that rang and said I recommended bicarb, I don't think I did recommend bicarb, so I'm interested to know what happened there. But yeah, obviously whenever you put something out, you have to be careful. Last week, probably one of the worst images I saw was a friend showed me a picture of a beautiful tawny frogmouth owl dead in her backyard. Mm. And, you know, she doesn't use rodenticides, but obviously the neighbour did. And so when you see a creature like that, and also, you know, yes, snakes, all sorts of things get poisoned by using you know, by using rodenticides. So we need to consider anything we put out there and its potential impacts on other creatures.
There you go, Rob. I hope that answered your question. Congratulations to Stan in Spalding and Terry in Broken Hill, who have won the ABC Gardening magazines. This texter says, my rats sought revenge as soon as I threw them the Deb. That's the Deb mashed potato. The rats attacked my cucumber plants, so now I've put on bird netting. Thank you. Yeah. Anne is near Tumby Bay. Anne, you are wanting to know the best way to deal with water gum suckers in your dam bank. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah.
Now, I wish I knew. Water gum is called Tristaniopsis, and it's a cousin of the Queensland box that many people know, and it's grown as a – Queensland box is grown as a street tree around Adelaide and has those little gum nuts that people hate because they get on footpaths. So I'm not familiar enough with this Tristaniopsis. Now, it's a East Coast higher rainfall plant. So I would imagine if it's found a dam, it probably thinks it's in heaven. Who I would suggest you call would be to contact someone like State Flora, you know, that specialise in Australian native plants. And even though they have a lot of local native plants, they also know about other gums and what to do. You know, I remember having a dam in several gardens ago, and one of the big gums that was planted near it basically put its root through the dam bank to get to the water, and, you know, ultimately that could create a pipe and cause leakage. So I think, you know, I'd follow that up with a native plant specialist.
Okay. Well, I could get hold of the Department of Ag people in Lincoln, I guess.
Yeah, or State Flora.
State Flora are probably better. Department of Ag may not. I'm sure they didn't suggest planting that tree, did they?
Well, these the water gums are traditionally in the lower areas, sort of along creek banks.
Oh, okay. So it's not what I'm saying. Okay, this is where common names are not good. Water gum is what they is a common tree. So yeah, contact your local landscape board and they'll be able to help you.
Ready? Yeah.
Thanks, Anne. Your phone is really ducking out there, so I hope you heard that from Sophie. And our last call in Talkback Gardening this morning comes from Stacey from Cleve. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, Deb. I'm hoping that Sophie's booked her ticket to the Eyre Peninsula Field Days, but in lieu of that, I'm very glad I can just bring in, you know, in March. Sophie, thanks so much for your advice with the western aspect. Now that it's had that lovely rain, we've prepared our bed and we're going to get our lily pilly hedge happening soon. So that was exciting. I don't know whether you remember giving me advice about which things may grow as a bit of a barrier. Anyway,
Stacey, you know, Cleve is one of my favourite places. So tell the Eyre Peninsula Yay! Field Days to invite me back.
All right, I will. I'm not on the committee, but I know someone. Anyway, we've just planted some agapanthus, and so we've got a lovely thing called the Grow Free initiative in Cleve, and so what you don't waste, and so it's share what you can and then take what you need. So the other day someone had white aggies, take them. So I've lined my whole beautiful bed with free, my favorite price, and then my question to Emma the producer was, I won't be planting bougainvillea here, but just out of interest, it really gets me when I want to plant Australian natives or a bougainvillea. They can't grow from a cutting, can they, my friend? I can't.
Yes.
Oh, I can. Oh,
they can.
Like a leucodendron or a grevillea or.
Okay.
Can they grow from
a cutting?
So
you could do, it's all based on the time. Bougainvilleas can grow from a cutting, but they're a subtropical. So you would do the cutting in springtime, late spring, as the new growth hardens off. Okay.
Okay.
If you do it in early spring, it'll wilt. Grevilleas and other natives will certainly grow from a cutting, but you have to choose a bit of wood that has no flower, or a bit of growth that has no flowers on it. Now, that period in late spring early summer as the growth is hardening off. You know, new growth is often when you pick it as a cutting, it just wilts. Once it hardens off, it doesn't wilt. You can also try some cuttings now if you haven't got growth on them. I would be looking at the new tips on the side, and that would be great. And when you're doing cuttings, if you can get a little bit with the skin on the bottom called a heel, that's always fantastic. Now, I'm just going to point something out, though, because this is a common misconception. You said leucodendrons. Leucodendrons are not native. Leucodendrons, leucospermums, and proteas are all South African. They're the same family. They're Proteaceae family. So same. They're related, like distant. Well, they're sort of related. They're in the same big family as a lot of our native plants, but they are not native. But they can be grown from cutting too. But you have to get a piece that doesn't have a flower on it, or if it has a flower on it, you have to cut the thing off, because if there's a flower, the cutting will not take root.
Okay, so really I just have to have patience, because I think what I've been doing, Sophie, is I've gone, hey, great, snap, so yeah. I don't forget, tonight I'll stick it in some soil, and then it just wilts and rots, yeah, like you just said. So it's absolutely a bit like a frangipani, let it seal itself off and then...
No. All these cuttings have to be done immediately, or if you look in a nurseryman's fridge, they'll probably have all these green, you know, those green fruit bags that keep things alive longer. I remember growing up and my mother had all those green fruit bags with cuttings in them that she was going to get to that she hadn't got to already. So those cuttings need to go in fresh. Do invest in a striking powder or a rooting hormone. And, you know, you've got amazing people over your part of the world like Dana, and I would be talking to her and say, Dana, I want to grow some plants. What am I doing wrong? And she'll be able to give you information.
Good luck with that, Stacey from Cleve. Thank you to everybody for your calls. Sophie, earlier when we had John Lamb in the studio, you were discussing an amazing zigzag C-channel shade cloth. We have had so many texts from so many people, including Paul from Meadows, Frosty, Helen, and a slew of other people saying, can you please explain it and can you put something in your newsletter?
Okay, well, can I just tell you, it's called Alloy Channel Plus Spring Set, and it is a game changer. And I'm so glad that, you know, I kept on saying to people that I was having challenges and they found it for me. I will share what it is in my newsletter. But Alloy Channel Plus Spring Set, sold by commercial people that supply the commercial growing industry, and it is amazing.
Wonderful. That is brilliant, Sophie. Well, look, thank you for another awesomely packed Saturday Talkback Gardening, and I look forward to doing it all over again with you next week.
Sounds wonderful, Deb. Happy gardening to all our listeners.